Okay, everyone. Good evening and welcome once again to our Voyage Through Life in the Labyrinth by E.J. Gold. E.J. has written a series of books, and Life in the Labyrinth actually is number two of a trilogy. The first being
The Human Biological Machine as a Transformation of Apparatus.
And these were written, I can't tell when it was written since I've lost the first.
You've lost your copyright page. I believe the original, I'm trying to remember the Human Biological Machine copyright, but this one is copyright 1986, so that would be the first printing.
Okay, so that's life. So these were documents that were put forth 30 years ago or 25 years ago.
That's right.
And some of the concepts were the actual documents that we're reading from were written at that time and published at that time, but they took form a few years before them, as Ivan has talked to us about in the past. But so we're dealing with material that's been around for quite a while. And I actually spoke with someone who's a well-studied in the area of Sufism, and he indicated that even today, after many years of looking at this material, he says, this is unique material. It's unequaled.
Yeah, I think, what I thought David was about to say was, these books, The Human Biological Machine and this book, in a sense, have already stood the test of time because this is, they're actually a generation old. Would you say? Is that it?
Well, they're full generation old.
Yeah, they're still in circulation and they're still in use. And I think, if anything, the readership is probably growing for these books.
But in any event, here we are. We've been working in the field of transformational psychology and the spiritual path for many years. And as we delve into this material, it's fresh and it's vibrant. And I think that's what I wanted to say, is that there's a lot of important material here for us to work with. So where we are now is that we're on chapter 13 of Life in the Labyrinth. And I think we're about halfway through. Is that about right, Ivan?
Yeah.
Ivan's just...
I'm trying to measure.
He's measuring.
We're a little past halfway.
A little past halfway, he says. And we're, you know, so most of the chapters we've been able, many of the chapters we've been able to do as in 1 week, but a number of them have taken us 2 weeks. And that's just because we're doing what I call the slow reading process. We're walking through until we understand what's said there. Our job here on this end of the camera, on this end of the phone, is to just facilitate that particular process. Now, this particular chapter coming up, is the chapter we're on now is chapter 13. This is a breakthrough chapter. In a certain way, and maybe I do want to be a little dramatic, this chapter is frightening. But it's frightening in a different way. It's not frightening in a macabre manner. It's frightening because of the responsibility that is laid out. And it indicates, in my opinion, quite clearly, that we do, not only do we have the responsibility, but we have the ability to do some of this work.
Yeah.
And we've been through the chapters, we've been through HBM, and actually Silverdale, you know, I'm hoping that you're going to be able to help us through this chapter a bit, at least in the first part of it for sure. And the whole concept of the what is it to bring the machine to life and then how that is exploded by EJ into a much broader concept for us here. So with that introduction, Ivan.
Right.
Why don't you get us started
summary.
With reading the header there, yeah.
The initiation of the Absolute. The Absolute is fragmented into an infinite number of parts which take the shape of a multidimensional labyrinth. The absolute, in the form of the creation, is the labyrinth through which we are voyaging. The great work is an attempt to bring the corpse of creation to the most profound state of livingness. I'm still in shock from rereading this chapter.
That's stunning. The great work is an attempt to bring the corpse of creation to the most profound state of livingness. I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs. I don't want to spend a lot of time on cosmology as such.
Right.
And hopefully Silverdale will help us through some of that part. In its native state, the absolute exists only in relation to itself as undifferentiated void. An ocean and a drop of water within water within water. And there is the veiled reference to the mystical Kabbalah. And I think Pianjo is, I can't remember the name, the Ein Sof, and then there's two levels above that, which is before creation, the void in its voidness. And then it begins to take form. The absolute has presence and attention. Listen to this now. But not existence, a state quite apart from anything knowable to the human primate consciousness. We really can't understand that because we are housed in the human biological machine, Ivan. This is us. We don't know how it can be different. And part of our work as becoming voyagers is standing in a different place. I'm just thinking of a conversation I had earlier this week with somebody where we talked about suddenly beginning to stand in a different place and accepting that part of who we are. And then you can begin to sense, maybe I'm not totally a thing, but I am attention and presence. And that's where the vibrancy is. So, but this is now being said, the absolute has presence and attention. It's not existence. Undifferentiated as it is, the absolute is able. Even so, by compounding process of self-induced semi-intentional shocks to form within itself, at its epicenter, in its deepest attention centrum, a high-energy plasma concentration, this is important, contained and suspended in a basket-like magnetic wave, a force field of positron-active electroconductance, which in its containment forms an electrically viscous high-density particle field, which we who dwell within it call the universe. But I want to point out to that, I mean, it's a poetic way of describing creation, the universe, etc. But note well the idea of a energy field, that this is an energy matrix.
Right.
Okay? The creation is spawned suddenly, automatically, always unexpectedly, and spasmodically, involuntarily, existing not out of design, but as a result of reflexive reaction, a harsh, ironic, barking laugh in an empty sky. And Silverdale, are you still there online?
Yes, I am.
And we've talked about this, you and I, and you've shared some about this process. And I was wondering if you could just take a couple of minutes and just chat about that. Is that okay? Or
absolutely. Just briefly, all of this is nothing more than a logical extension of Gurdjieff's ideas, and it's really important to understand the groundwork that Gurdjieff lays, which is simply this. We are comprised of three separate, independent, autonomous, diverse, co-equal, heterogeneous forces. Sadly, in our lifetime, we only develop one of these three forces, which we identify as our historical personality together with our organic body. And the other two forces atrophy and are undeveloped over the course of our of an ordinary life. What EJ does so marvelously well in Human Biological Machine and then develops further in this particular book is introduces us to a second force, which is an inherent part of us, but which we're never educated to become familiar with, namely our essential self. And the way I explain our essence or our essential self and what this chapter seems to be indicating is that it is the life force of the absolute, which is undifferentiated. It's white light and infinite extension, and it and a characteristic of that condition is vibratory. It's vibrational. It has a vibrational frequency. So a lot of our efforts toward self-transformation is to attempt to become familiar with that vibratory sensation within ourselves, which is our essence. And this can only be achieved if we gradually pacify our historical personality through personal efforts. Now, once we've managed to stimulate our essence, that is a vibratory sensation within ourselves, we gradually learn how to blend that absolute with our body, which is being described as the creation in this chapter,
right.
And the blending of those two produce this third force of personal, individualized, independent beingness, and that's what everybody wants to do: become a god with all of the attendant powers. But it can only be achieved by going through first this chapter, which is how do we stimulate our essence, so that it can awaken our physical body and allow our physical body to participate in the transformational process. How's that for a summary?
Good. I mean, that gets us started.
Yeah, it's good.
Very good. It's exactly where we want to wind up. In essence, dare I say, that is the Human Biological Machine in a nutshell. The book, The Human Biological Machine, as a transformational apparatus. It's beginning to understand that we have two electrical bodies, and those electrical bodies beginning to work together. Now, I want to point out again, I want to point out something, and Susan will be very familiar with this idea of recognizing that vibratory sensation, okay? That's the distinction I'm making here for us, for us as individual workers, each one of us here. When we're in this state where I call it the descent of grace, when that's starting to move through us, when we move into that space, note it. How do you note it? With your attention. You're noting that, and if that vibratory sensation will become is objectively recognizable. And when you are together, when two or more of us, as one of the individuals said last year, week, are together, this presence is there too when we are together. Tianzhou is working with the idea of, you know, that what is the entity that is forming when we come together? And he's posed that, and now, of course, it's before all of us to consider, and we will continue to consider it. So here's the absolute thing. Has now moved into extension, this reflex, as EJ said, suddenly creation has started. And then creation is there in a certain way. It's extended out there, and the absolute is stuck to it. It's not able to do anything other than with that creation. And yet the creation is dead.
It's not alive, yeah.
It's not alive. It lacks its own livingness. And so, And so jumping ahead of a page or so, in the italics, there's a paragraph that starts with, so knew during creation what becomes of the absolute. The answer to this question forms the basis of the great work. During the creation, the absolute is entrapped by it, because although the creation just happens by itself and reflects reaction, it is created of the absolute. This idea is clearly expressed by the secret esoteric meditative phrase, I had nothing but myself with which to create the world. Out of myself, then, the world was made. One consequence of which is that the absolute temporarily loses the quality of absoluteness without losing the being of the absolute. Now, I don't want to get too stuck in the cosmology. But we've got a tiger by the tail is maybe a nice way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean that's that would, this one that you just read, I can't say that I'm convinced of that or that I understand it fully. But I mean, I think you just have to live with it.
Well, we can live with it. I think that for me, whenever I start to visualize it, I really do have to look at the Tree of Life, and I should have brought that Tree of Life symbol again, where there in the manifestation is Kether down to Melkut, where we are. And that's the creation has now manifested, and the Absolute is stuck in it. It's part of it, and there it rests. And
and by the way, David, this is what gives us the possibility of transformation, because our body, like the creation, is dead, and only through self-initiated efforts can we find ways to activate our essence, which then allows for the transformation of personal being.
Yes, and we're going to get to that particular point in about two or three pages, because that's where the rubber hits the road, so to speak. And what we're talking about is awakening the machine. We understand, if we begin to understand the idea that when we know how to awaken the machine by placing our attention on the machine, it starts to, the ego of the machine starts to diminish ever so slightly. Our attention starts to fill it, and as it slows down in a sense, then the essential self can come to play. We can look around from those sets of eyes. As Spinoza says, to see through the eyes of God, you know, stand in that place of eternality. So, we have to awaken the machine. We are thankful that we have a machine. We are thankful that we have a machine, because that gives us the plateau in which to do the work. Without it, we are just angelic beings, and they are just an adoration with nowhere else to go, in a sense. Okay? I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here, a couple of pages once again. And it starts with a paragraph, at some point in the development of our macro-dimensional life, page 145 in the new edition.
Yes, 128 in this one.
128 in the old one. Now, I want to ask some of the big players online here. At some point in the development of our macro-dimensional life, the option presents itself to sacrifice our normal destiny, which would have been painless, joyful death, generally coming directly on the heels of a painful, joyous dying, as we permanently sever our ties to the creation and reunite with the formless void in a return journey to the absolute, total dissolution into the cosmic ocean of life. What is meant by at some point in the development of our macro-dimensional life, the option presents itself to sacrifice our normal destiny?
Well, there's not anything online yet.
No definitive answers on the question yet? Oh, my.
Not online, but I mean, I do think at some point we have a choice to continue our sleeping life or to choose to try to wake up.
Yeah, I think he's definitely referring to that. I think he's also, the way that he's composed this passage, it reminds me of the Bodhisattva vow also, which is to say, you know, you just get to pass over, you know, you get to, or in this case, it's sort of like the automatic version of union, of going back to union, which is you die and you go into the white light, as we have in the book of the, you know, this book of the dead information. But there's another choice, you know, which is if you're you have to qualify for that choice. You have to do the work. You have to bring yourself
to
have this choice.
Wait a minute. What did you say before that? What was the word?
With the Bodhisattva vow?
No.
There's another choice, an option.
You have to qualify.
You have to qualify, yeah.
You're not even in the game. It's a non-question until you get to the point where you qualify.
Well, this is what all this language in this passage is about. He's saying, well, this is the ordinary lot of man, is to drag through, you know. what is that saying about life is hell, then you die. Life is difficult, then you die. That's about it. You know, and this is so... What's the option? What's the other option? Actually, he says in various kind of tongue-in-cheek ways that the other option is much more difficult. This is going to be, you know, you don't have any idea what pain is, you know, what you're in for, until you choose this Bodhisattva route.
Okay, the point I'm trying to make here is that everybody that is, I don't know who's online at all. I know that Silverdale and Susan are here, and Molly and Ivan, myself, everybody that's online right now has got to a point where they have qualified for this problem, qualified for this point, where Susan posed, you know, a very interesting platform there. She says, well, at some point you get to a moment where you must decide, do I want to wake up or stay asleep? Do you think the average human even has that as a question?
For us, is it really a choice?
Ah, thank you. And then she says, and for us, is it even really a choice? Because what we're talking about is, once the door starts to open, it opens because we've done a certain kind of work that starts to unveil what Silverdale was telling us, this vibratory sensation.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the flower starts to bloom, and suddenly you see a little hint of color there, and you're fascinated by it, and you're not going to turn away. Okay? Once you qualify, then you begin to get into this kind of trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just starting, okay? And it gets worse as we go through. So I ask, and this is a question that maybe some of us can chew on later, but it's, how do you sacrifice your normal destiny?
So we do have a couple of comments now.
Go for it, please.
Or I had said earlier, we choose to come back and not aim for liberation, but to come back to help others.
Correct.
And then I have another comment from Godfrey. It says, through our work, we reach a point to offer ourselves for our own liberation, but for our own sake, or for surrender ourselves totally to a greater work.
So remember these terms here that these individuals are posting. Surrender ourselves. return for service. Okay, these are going to come up. Thank you so much, Susan.
You're welcome.
I say it's the way. We talk about the way of service here.
Okay, so we don't know what we mean yet by the way of service, but I think in this chapter it begins to unveil itself to us. And then jumping ahead again, in the strictest sense, what we call life of the machine is only another form of death. The biological machine is just as dead as the whole of creation. You see that, Ivan?
Yeah, this is the correspondence.
Okay. So we understand, as we begin to work on awakening the machine, we begin to understand what it means to that it's dead. When we don't work to awaken it, it is a form of death. And now the horror starts. EJ says, all of creation is like that. Well, the life of the machine partakes of death, the life of the essential self. Now, this is exactly what Silverdale was saying in the next phrase. A fragmented remnant of the absolute, engulfed in creation, is the only part of creation which can be said to be really alive. What? What does this mean? Anybody? So the machine partakes of this. The essential self is a fragmented part of the absolute. And it's the only part of creation which can be said to be really alive. Do we understand this?
The machine is robotic without, what, say it again? Will, without will or life. Yeah, in the correspondence, the creation is mechanical. That's what I get out of it. So the creation is habitual, is completely repetitive and stuck in its in a groove.
But I want to say, I want to get to this other, the other half of the sentence here. It says, that the essential self is a fragment of the absolute. Okay, does this ring true to you? Does this ring true? Can we vote on this?
Well, we're saying that creation is to the absolute as the machine is to the essential self. So then the essential self would be the only part of us that is truly alive.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So then
we are a little fragment. We are a small fragment then, 1/4 of an inch of the absolute. All right? The essential self is that.
Yeah, or again, in Kabbalah, it's the sparks that are spread out. The sparks are all spread out in the ashes and the dead matter. And the sparks need to be regathered. The sparks need to come create a fire
okay,
again.
Okay, so now he's talking.
The vessels need, the broken vessels get reassembled, etc.
The broken vessels, yeah. And we cleanse the vessel. When cleansing the vessel, what we really mean is awakening the machine so that the essential self, this vibratory force, starts to come alive. Now, how does that relate to the absolute?
Yeah, this is the question I have. That's part of the shock to me of reading this chapter. Okay.
Go for it.
Which is to say, if I use my presence and attention and I awaken this machine, I want to bring my body mind into the waking state.
And then
what do I do with it?
Then the machine is in the waking state.
The machine is
and then the essential self begins to
it becomes active instead
becomes
of passive.
Active
in
instead
the terminology of the previous book. But the thing is, what I want to know is that if I've brought the machine into the waking state, is it now in that heightened state, the highest state of aliveness, or is there some formula or some ritual or something I need to do as the essential self to bring that machine into the higher state of aliveness and vividness?
I see. You're asking us to go back and read HBM and go through the chapters on the interaction between the machine.
Well, that's bringing the woman to life.
the bringing
which
the woman to life
directly to this chapter
is
here.
Precisely
yeah.
for this chapter, and it has the concept of where the machine starts to, starts to mimic, in a sense, the essential self, which empowers the essential self. And what was it again?
Well, there's a dance between those two. There's also the electrical phenomenon.
And what was the fire that is the source of that? Does anybody remember? We're going to hit it.
Silverdale.
No, we're going to hit it in a few paragraphs.
Yeah.
Silverdale probably remembers. But it's adoration.
Yeah, the adoration.
And so in adoration, this dance becomes vibrant. And we can begin to consider at that moment, as that interplay, it's very important to have a sense of the interplay between the two, these two dramatic electrical bodies that we are housed in. We have come forth in this manner. And the essential self then awake begins to come alive and become vibrant. And when it becomes alive and vibrant, we've begun to do the great work.
And I like what it says in HBM. It's a process of mutual initiation between the essential self and the human biological machine.
Reciprocal initiation, right?
Exactly.
Right.
Which is what David's referring to, is that each one feeds the aliveness back to the other. It's a dance, a mimicry or a dance. But what intrigues me about this chapter here is that it seems to me another whole, what would you call it, esotericism. It's another secret that he's building on top of this, which is the one, the as below, so above secret, which is to say that this microcosm, this essential self and machine of mine, is a reflection, a microcosm, of the greater reality, of the larger reality.
Look at any of the Western esoteric information and you see that. What is it, I don't remember all the terms, but...
He has them listed at the end here if you want them, actually.
Not yet,
chapter.
Not yet. But now let's jump ahead.
Can I throw in a few comments?
Please do.
Please, yeah.
And everybody else, turn your hymnals to page 149 as you get ready for this, where the paragraph is, how utterly astounding to realize. That's the paragraph we're going to start in. But first, a word from my sponsor. Susan.
First, we have Aura is saying the divine spark of the absolute is truly real, truly alive in us, the only part of us.
Yes. Nice.
She clarified and says the divine spark of the absolute is the only part of us.
Yeah.
The divine spark.
It's a mirror. At some point we begin to sense the fact we are that absolute. That little teeny part of us is what we are carrying. We are carrying that divine spark. And when we do the work to awaken that machine and allow it to start unfolding its angelic wings, at that point, that little inch of the absolute can become alive. I'm going to jump
to
that. Go.
We have World Worker says that shocks give us leverage as beings.
That's actually Molly Midway.
And she's saying the essential self can bring forth the miracle of bringing the dead creation to life.
Yes. Critical point.
Yes.
Critical point. And that's the essence of this chapter. Now, how utterly astounding to realize the predicament of the absolute through our own experience of the invincible power of the momentum of the machine. Imagine the crushing power and momentum of creation in the maintenance of its corpse-like state. How can the absolute hope to encourage the creation of its own will of its own will to life. This, in technical terms, is called, but only on the highest macro-dimensional level from the absolute to creation, the invitation. Now, that's the beauty of this chapter, and that's the, it's so, what a beautiful terminology.
Mm-hmm.
There's an invitation, not a demand, or I'm going to wake you up or else, or
mm-hmm.
anything like that. It's come forth. I present the invitation. The secret of the invitation is well kept. Except we're seeing it discussed in broad daylight in this book, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And jumping ahead, as the human biological machine can become a transformational apparatus by being brought to life and awakened, creation can also become a transformational apparatus for the absolute in the same way. And what real hope can there be for the absolute other than utilization of the creation as an evolutionary apparatus?
Mm-hmm.
Wow. In considering that nothing within creation will ever change. The machine has a will of its own, and because the creation is related by corresponding to the machine, we know what it must be like to have a will of its own, equally powerful and unbreakable. Like the human biological machine also seeks the dark, lethargic sleep of forgetfulness, the touch of Lethe, the bringer of death, the ultimate steady state. And that's the one of the rivers in Hades, actually. There are five, I believe.
Yeah, this is the one that you bathe in to...
forgetfulness.
To remove all the memories of the lifetime you just had.
And so that's the river of forgetfulness. And so that's the choice. That's the choice. We know that the essential has two and only two genuine powers, the will of attention and presence, and that these two acts of will are sufficient forces in awakening of the human biological machine. So we can understand, as is being indicated here, that by awakening the machine, beginning to do that, then we can unleash the power of will and attention. It's the interplay. It's this interplay.
And he's addressing this. This is actually addressing the question that I raised here, because he says, you can and must learn to develop will of attention and presence and apply these to the awakening of the creation.
Okay. So then now comes forth
the job,
part of our work and part of the work before us. And I posed in the email that I sent out is, you know, can we help? Can we help the absolute? Or we're just lumps down here, right? Well, here's what. Is Piangio on?
I don't think so, David.
Okay, maybe he didn't make it, but Harry wrote that that's Piangio on the website. Here's his response. Can we help the absolute? Not only can we help, it seems that the author is saying that we are the only creature, the only heterocosmos form chosen by our Creator to lend a helping hand in a specific way that only we can, through presence and adoration or prayer. And if we can, we ought to. When linked together with other humans in this work, we form the corpus of the Absolute. This is what you were saying earlier about the divine sparks.
Well, then the morphology, that's the change of morphology that he keeps referring to.
And that we spoke of last week.
Yeah.
And as each of us awakens, a part of creation is rejoined. As each of us awakens, a part of creation is rejoined in spiritual life. People like Hafiz say, this makes God smile. Of course, this business of working with others is a risky business. But what else is one to do when experiencing such loneliness? So we begin to see what's possible for us here. Ivan, I'm a little worried Are we going to...
What do you think? 2 weeks on this chapter?
I don't know. We're not making a lot of progress here.
Well, I don't know. If this book gets any more profound than this chapter, you know, this is pretty... This is really a success. Actually, I think that the formula is actually very simple, right?
Okay.
But like I said, it's a shock to me to read this because, you know, I think that this is... you know, I understand. I guess I acknowledge this idea that Susan or somebody in the group said that we don't have a choice. You know, that we're, you know, after a certain point of awakening, okay, we're committed or compelled to this path. On the other hand, I mean, this reading this chapter, it reminds me of there's a famous poem by Rilke, by the German poet Rilke, where it's about some beautiful sculpture, some Greek, like, archaic sculpture or classical sculpture, and he doesn't describe this whole thing. And there's a line at the end of this poem, he says, you have to change your life. It's like there's something about this artwork that is so stunning and so profound and shocking to him that he says, this is telling me that I have to change my life. We have to do something different. We have to make something different out of our lives. And that's how this chapter strikes me. It's like this is, I mean, I better just tear this up and burn it, you know, or else pay attention to it because this is, you know, you just can't, I don't think that I could read this every week and just, and remain habituated. I mean, it's like it caused me to change a lot of habits.
So we're going to take our time here. I'm not going to, because there's some really important points as we go ahead, and I don't want to gloss over them for the sake of our short time. We still have a little bit of time tonight, but I'm going to slow down a little bit, okay? That's okay with everyone.
Yeah, you know what else, David, is I think that it's, we have people, the other great advantage, the great thing about this group of people that are in this circle together, we have a lot of different backgrounds and a lot of different traditions that people are versed in. And I think that there's, you know, the cross references like to Kabbalah and all, you know, all of these other the correspondences in here are very strong. And
very
strong. I think it's worth talking about them. Yeah.
So jumping ahead just a little bit to the next paragraph, the Absolute is dependent upon the shamanic voyager, an individualized, consciously functioning fraction of itself for this service. Let's read that previous paragraph. Let's finish it. We never finished it. So the essence has the power of will and attention, attention and presence, and that these two acts of will are sufficient forces in awakening the human biological machine, responding as it does to the compelling pressure of attention. Listen to that. The compelling pressure of attention by coming to life. In the same way as voyagers, shamanic voyagers, workers, can and must learn to develop will of attention and presence and apply these to the awakening of creation. So listen to this phrase here, this compelling pressure of attention. If you actually put your attention on this stuff, you know, I'm just thinking of three phone calls I had this week with individuals. We put our attention on certain things, and stuff that wasn't there before came forth. It's the compelling pressure of attention. You know, feel that within you, and then you will have the sense of exercising that. And for the first time, we have the sense of exercising will. I know that it's the form for many, many, many teachers. Oh, you can't do, you have no will, here's everything you can't do, blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Just control negative emotions.
Control negative emotions, send me your check, and so on and so forth. And I appreciate that process. But now I'm saying at the same time, own the fact that you do have this compelling pressure of attention that you can apply from time to time. Just because you believe that it's automatic in other people, it's incorrect. You maybe you look at somebody who you think is, oh, they're all advanced, and it's automatic, this mm-hmm. compelling presence. No, it isn't. They're just, it's such a cool thing. They're doing it all the time. They always yeah. want to play. They want to write that poem or look at that sculpture again and again. And that it's called the compelling pressure of attention because it compels a movement. It's right here. It says it by coming, responding as it does to the compelling pressure by coming to life. So the machine comes to life. We know this. We understand this. We know that that's how it goes. We know that that's how it goes. And my point of that is that that's where we can go to. However small your compelling pressure of attention may be, it does exist. Okay? It doesn't, maybe you're not a London Symphony player, but you know how to play. So take that as your compelling challenge, in a sense, and move forward. Because the next paragraph, the absolute is dependent on the shamanic voyager, an individualized, consciously functioning fraction of itself for the service of awakening the creation. Mm-hmm. Does this make sense to us? Susan, how are we doing?
I don't have any. Well, I do have a comment. Becky Sunnybrook says that attention and presence are what we have to work on, and that's how to connect with the absolute.
Yes.
Awakening of the creation work.
Yes.
There's not a lot.
Okay.
So these are, let's say again, going back to the human biological machine, the transformational apparatus, this idea of the limb that's fallen asleep. I mean,
yeah.
The attention and presence are, you have to, these are muscles that, you know, like the use of these tools are, it may be atrophied. So, I mean, we're in the process of bringing forth, of exercising this attention and presence of the essential self. And so there are those pains, aches and pains, like the tingling, you know, of when the limb has been asleep,
yeah.
and you've got to flex it and
yeah.
move it, and you've got to get it into motion and so on. And so we're going through those kinds of sensations, let's say, and experiences with doing this exercise, you know, doing this, or carrying out this obligation, you might say.
Right.
You know, but this is the, what do you call it? It's the, this is the given duty. You know, this is the task at hand.
But it's only a task at hand for those who have qualified.
If you should accept this mission, this.
It is
self-destructive.
It is virtually a mission impossible,
yeah.
but it's not totally impossible. It's almost impossible. But nevertheless, there's a crack of hope here. And every time, every individual that's here that awakens the machine or puts themselves in a place where that vibratory sensation is occurring, that moment is one moment in what I call the battle against powers and principalities.
Yeah, and we're going to do this. Hey, we're going to do this against all odds, right? I mean, we're going to go against the odds. This is like EJ would say, hey, you just put all your chips on midnight. You just put it all on double sixes. And you just say, what are the odds against those double sixes coming up? Well, we don't care. This is it. We know what the odds are. We're going to do this anyway, you know, in a sense. Or the other one is about, like, throwing the yogurt in the lake, you know.
Right.
Hey, do you think we can change this whole lake to yogurt? Well, we can give it a try.
Well, I had a couple.
Hey, go ahead.
go ahead for me?
Here, Susan's got it.
Go ahead, Susan.
Okay, so Hawk Lady was first asking about the pressure and whether that's self-imposed. And then she received an answer from Becky Sunnybrook saying that, yes, just like when you're in love, lots of attention is involved with that. But it's not all self-willed. It is the machine, and that is not what is needed, it seems. It takes something else.
EJ talks about the force of attention.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like the beam, the concentrated beam of your attention has force. You know, when you bring that to bear, so you know it's not like arm wrestling. It's not an aggressive struggle. You know, to exercise this attention. It's not a competition, but it's the intensification, the concentration of attention that creates that compulsion or whatever.
Yeah, but I want to expand the idea of what do we mean here by attention.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just like the mental power that of concentration. That's
right.
It's not just, it is what Becky said, Sunnybrook, I guess it is, what she said was something, you've used this term love. This is partly what we're talking about. We'll get to that in a little while. We'll get to it maybe next week, this idea of adoration. And that, Hawk Lady, is where the pressure comes from. It comes from a combination of really directing that, and that compels us a certain, that's the pressure. And if we have the power, this is an interesting phrase for the men, too, if we have the power to surrender, because we know that we can hang out in that level of space, if we can allow ourselves to be in this fire, this crucible of adoration, and adoration and attention, that's the compelling pressure, Hawk Lady. And you know that space. You know that space. The difficulty is hanging out in it 1/10 of a second longer each time.
Because it is voluntary. It's not something automatic. It's the opposite of an automaticity.
Yes.
It's not something
well put.
Not something reflexive or convulsive like this creation entity of the universe is talking about. You have to voluntarize it. You have to want it. You have to do it, let's say, every moment.
Yeah.
You have to continue it. Early.
So we get into these spaces. It's when you find yourself there. Maybe that's all we can say at the moment. We can go into a whole conversation about that we got from the HBM about how to awaken the machine.
Mm-hmm.
But we're now in a position, once you find yourself there, that's what we're talking about, Ivan.
Yeah, I think that's really valuable to talk about that.
We're already, now that once you've felt yourself there, now you can surrender to it and apply more attention, put more attention in each moment, because it's a worthy thing to do. It's worthy to do it. It makes sense to do it. It's worth the stretch.
I don't know, David. I don't know if it makes sense to do it. I would say it feels right to do it.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, if for us, let's say after a certain point, it's a sensation or something that you know is on the beam, in the zone.
So work with this idea that you have that we have every once in a while, we've worked with, of feeling compelled to be in these spaces. Feel compelled to be in those spaces. And once you're in this space, once you're there, then look around. Look around and sense it and say, okay. And now when you sense it, just surrender one more time to it, and one more time. Because a little door is open, and it is open for you. It's open for us. Since it is so open, take that opportunity. Someone has knocked on the door.
Mm-hmm.
Angels can't do this, by the way.
No.
Oh, goodness gracious.
No pudenda.
Well, that's a whole other conversation,
yeah, right.
But you're right. But you're right. So, I don't think we started a little bit late, but we're not out of time as such, but...
Well, we're about
are we out of time?
Well, we're out of time, but we are just about halfway through the chapter.
We are, okay.
The point that you reached, yeah.
What questions do you want to pose for us to chew on for next week? Because we're going to finish the chapter next week. We'll do it again. On wingsofchaos.com is the website, by the way. www.wingsofchaos.com, Life in the Labyrinth, and all the chapters are listed there.
Mm-hmm.
And the comment I read was from Harry on chapter 13. So if you have any questions you'd like to pose right now, I'm just interested, do you have a sense of this? Does this interaction between your essential self and creation and the absolute...
Do you have a question?
Feel right for you. Yes, please, Susan.
What does a Voyager bring to the work as far as what does a Voyager have to offer?
And who is asking this?
This is Becky.
Becky, okay, Becky.
Becky Sunnybrook.
So the first half of the question is,
what does a Voyager bring to the work?
Bring to the work.
Okay. And
so what aren't these to work on for
next
week?
So what does the Voyager, what does the Voyager bring to the work? Right?
And what does the Voyager have to offer?
What does the Voyager have to offer?
Yeah, they go together, but that's okay.
I think I have one that I'd like to ask, just because this is something that bothers me off and on. When I reach the state, the degree, let's say whatever it is, the degree of awakening or the degree of an awakened state of the machine, when I feel and sense this deadness of the machine or the deadness of the creation itself, what do I do at that point? Because I find that to be very horrifying, like he says. It gives me a very negative sensation. It has a very weighty and very...
Can somebody type this in that into the log,
feeling.
Please, as a second question from Ivan?
Yeah, I'm just
see and sense the death, how dead...
The heaviness of it.
The heaviness of the death of either the machine or creation.
Yeah, at that point, I'm just wondering if any of you or all of you could address from your experiences or from the process of your work with awareness, like what have you found to do at that point if you've experienced that perception, that sensation?
Two very important questions then from Becky and from Ivan. Okay?
So those are in the log.
Thank you. Okay, so we'll take it up again. It's worth it to reread the chapter for the next week because it is truly a stirring conclusion. It is really...
Yeah.
Quite something when we get to the end of this. I read it again just before I came. I was stunned again.
I think, yeah, not only that, the ending is obviously so powerful and so revelatory that it required almost a two-page joke before, as a lead-in.
Okay, so thank you for coming. This was Life in the Labyrinth, Chapter 13, Part 1, and we'll take up Part 2 next week at the same time, Wednesday, 7 o'clock, right here. Take care.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks, David and Ivan.
Thank you, Silverdale, for your great help with us clarifying that first part.
And thank you, Susan.
Susan.
You're welcome. Yay.